Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to be talking about Shotcut, a really, really cool video editor. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 493, recorded August 15th, 2018, Shotcut. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove an infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/floss. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show and play with it. I think today is going to be one of those. I'm going to welcome back my lovely and talented co-host, Aaron Newcomb. Aaron, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Randall. Glad to be here.
It looks like you're in your lair in East Bay somewhere.
Yes. I'm at home in my – you can't see actually my lair. That's my wife's lair. All the books. Oh, okay. And teachery stuff back there. That's her lair. And my lair is this way. And unfortunately, you can't see that because, of course, the camera's facing me. So, sorry. You don't get to see all my cool stuff.
And is it that way because her side of the room is cleaner than your side?
Well, right now, absolutely. I mean, the other problem is all the kids are on. I have another computer over here, and we're always playing games and stuff. And so the kids are always here, and like there's like wrappers and just stuff like books and things all over my desk. Some, half of it's mine, half of it's theirs. It's a I'm not a hoarder by any means, but you would think so, but probably by looking at this desk right now. So it's probably a good thing you can't see it.
Right. And I have a brand new background for those of you watching the video. No, that's not a spaceship. All the rooms here at ZipRecruiter in ZipRecruiter headquarters on the first floor are named after their local beaches. And this one's named after Huntington Beach. And so behind me, if you can watch the video, you can see the Huntington Beach Pier. And so, yes, it's not a spaceship. It's just a pier. It just appeared. All right. Well, we have a really great show lined up today, and especially apropos to the two of us, since we've done some video editing before. We're going to be talking about Shotcut, which is a free and open source cross-platform video editor. And it looks like it's mostly the exclusive work. I probably got that wrong, but we'll see. We'll get it right in a minute. Of Dan Dennity, who's actually going to be joining us in a few minutes to talk about this. Now, video editing is the process of bringing together multiple video content and possibly extra audio content and then hooking it all together so that you have like transitions to go from one screen to another and you can have multiple shots mixed into like picture in picture, that sort of stuff. I've done a bunch of video editing. In fact, back in the late 90s, I guess it would be, no, mid 90s, somewhere in there. I was doing I was working for Cable Access and did a lot of Cable Access stuff, but I wanted to do music videos commercially for bands that were local. Portland's full of bands, of course. So I bought, I don't know how much I paid for, I think like $4,000 back in 1991, so it was a lot of money, to buy a system, a Mac system, that ran Adobe Premiere, which is sort of like the gold standard for many, many years. And I bought just enough disk so that I could take 3 5-minute pieces of videotape, not physical videotape, the rendering of those onto a disc, and then I could mix those down onto the fourth resulting mix track. And I tell you, I think it was something like 100 megabytes a disc or something, which back then was insanely expensive. So that's my experience with that. And back then we used to call them non-linear video editing systems because you could actually go and jump from one cut to another right away and mix it back and forth. When we were doing videotape editing, we would have to have it was called an A-B roll. You'd have like two tapes going at the same time, going onto a third record tape. And, oh, it was so much worse, I tell you, once we switched over that. But, of course, now all video editing is done nonlinear, so the term nonlinear is completely irrelevant now. And, Aaron, I understand you had a little bit of experience as well.
Yeah, actually, around that same time frame, I was finishing up my minor. I got a minor in broadcasting in school, and so so for my video editing course, I actually learned to edit video on a video toaster. Some of you may remember that from the Amiga days. Very popular, actually, video editing system at the time. Everybody was using it, from hobbyists to actually professional studios, and so that's where I cut my teeth, so to speak. And then later on, I started looking for open source. When I started doing my podcast called The Source back in 2006, I wanted to do the whole thing with open source software. So I started looking for open source video editors, and I found Cinelera and used that pretty much the whole time I was doing that show. And that's actually where, I think that's how I met Dan way back when. Was actually, I was working on that. Maybe I was in a forum or something and Dan answered a question. I can't remember exactly how we met, to be honest. My memory's not very good, but I think it was something to do with Cinelera or somehow, you know, that podcast, that video show that I was doing way back then using Cinelera open source, non-linear digital editor. Is how we met. So yeah, I've got some experience doing video editing for sure.
Well, it looks like we're going to have to get into the show pretty quick here because we definitely got some questions we want to ask Dan to get all caught up on what he's been doing since then and also what Shotcut is actually about. But before we do that, I have a very important message because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with Droplets, virtual machines that are scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized Droplets and customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. The easy-to-use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance. Access the compute resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you pay per month with a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Included at no additional cost, 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including mine, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/floss. That's do.co/FLOSS for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. And let's go ahead and bring on Dan. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in San Francisco East Bay in a suburb of Oakland called Castro Valley. And I have a little story to tie together all of our video editing background that, okay, you know, to tie into what you guys had just said. When I was studying computer science at University of Cincinnati, I was an Amiga geek and got a little bit into the video toaster. And there was my first job out of the university was for a company called Digital Processing Systems that made add-on cards for personal computers, the first one to go along with the video toaster to provide what's called a time-based corrector. Mm. And then they made this other card, which worked with the 3D software Lightwave that came with the toaster to had a video output port and a dedicated SCSI controller on it. And it would, every frame that would get recorded would be written onto that hard drive. And then when the animation was done, it would take, you know, hours to render, to ray trace. Then you could just play it out at full broadcast quality and motion. And then they coupled those together to make one of the earliest digital video recorders. And if you look behind me, you can see this box perception. Oops, the other way. VR. That was one of their first cards for the, you know, DOS and Windows PCs, and it worked with Premiere, among some other NLEs as well. So that's my story.
Great.
That's how I got into all this. Yeah.
So we're here specifically to talk about Shotcut and its history. Right. I understand something, the core of it was called MLT. Can you describe what that is and then tell how that developed into Shotcut?
MLT is a multimedia like authoring and processing framework. So it provides both like an object model API for creating a time-based multimedia composition and manipulating it, and then serializing it out to XML and deserializing it back in. And it also provides the execution or processing engine that can operate in either real-time or non-real-time for rendering purposes. So it can be used for play-out as well for rendering and encoding.
So this is like the brain of Shotcut.
I basically tell people it's the engine of Shotcut and other video editors as well. But it was originally developed for what's called a broadcast video playout server under a 6-month contract back in 2004. The winter of 2004, okay. Basically, yeah.
So what had you then take that engine and decide to put your own wrapper on it? I mean, if there's already some existing stuff that uses as well, what was your distinguishing point for Shotcut?
Okay. So originally MLT, or which I will now pronounce just MELT from now on. Okay. It was only really designed and initially written to run on Linux operating systems, and then BSD as well, because it was easily portable on POSIX systems, right? But near the end of the 2000s, there was some interest in going cross-platform, and that's both personal as well as other people and contributors. And there was a need to have initially a test bed, cross-platform test bed for developing the cross-platform capabilities of MLT or MELT. So that was the initial motivation. But then I also thought, well, maybe I'll make a web service API for MELT, you know, a cloud service. We didn't call it cloud at the time, right?
No.
That was kind of new. That was around, you know, this thinking is around 2010. But I also wanted a way that people who were writing, authoring MLT XML, that they could preview the results cross-platform, even including rendering, encoding settings and stuff like that before having to actually like turn to a service and wait for that turnaround time to get, you know, to type in some XML. If you remember like programming on mainframes, you'd have to submit a job and wait for it to come back and get your results. So I didn't want to like have that. I wanted to provide some kind of tool cross-platform because a lot of developers I knew would be on Windows and Mac OS. So that was some of the original motivations. But then Qt 5 came out shortly thereafter. And so I needed a way to upgrade the MELT component that uses Qt to work with Qt 5 cross-platform. There was also some new UI technologies in Qt 5 that I was interested in and exploring, and decided to go through Shotcut. And there's also, I had become a cross-platform person myself and really valued a lot these free software solutions in different categories, you know, like audio editing, you know, you have Audacity, GIMP for image editing, and so on and so forth. There's like in every category, there's like a free software killer application. But there wasn't really for multi-track video editing. So I wanted to establish something there.
Cool. And actually, we have a question from the chat room already. Eric Duckman. So is this yet another GUI front end to FFmpeg?
Oh, okay, that's a good question. There's yes and no. Melt heavily relies upon FFmpeg, but it uses the library APIs, and it's not a direct mapping. There's some things that don't quite fit well, like the libav filter graph mechanism. We can expose individual filters, but not like the whole graph system. In any case, but there's more things under that umbrella than just FFmpeg. And it's not just a simple command line front end. There's a lot of command line front ends, GUI front ends for FFmpeg, but you cannot do full time-based compositions just using FFmpeg command lines. So this framework adds basically a whole lot of aspects of time-based composition.
So a typical use for a shortcut might be making YouTube videos, right? Little short things.
Yeah.
Does it scale well to larger projects?
That's a good question. It can scale well on larger projects to 64-bit systems, and if you keep the number of tracks to a reasonable level, it'll chug through it, but the more you throw in as far as layers and effects, the slower it will get, because it's still heavily CPU-based, a lot of the image processing. There is some GPU processing that's available, but that's for the image processing, separate from, say, the decoding and encoding aspects. But that's a little unstable with its integration. It's still considered experimental, and that's very promising. You know, it could help out a lot. But that's basically the story. On a 32-bit process, though, especially on Windows, it's limited to 2 gigs of RAM, and you can quickly deplete that. But there are some mechanisms in Melt to facilitate large projects. Like, you just can't have open thousands of file handles, and people will throw in thousands of images, you know, into a composition. So there's a mechanism whereby objects can use something called a cache, but it's basically used to not try to hold more things in memory, but to allow older things to be removed from memory, older things that can be quickly and easily reestablished in memory. So when this Melt object, let's say it has a file open, but you put it into the cache with a destructor function pointer that tells it how to close, right? When it needs it next in one of its callback functions, it'll try to get it out of the cache. If it's a cache miss, then it would recreate the file and add it back into the cache. Do you see what I mean? And the same thing, say, with image buffers and stuff like that, things that are heavy. So you can have a bunch of Melt objects that are basically shells that can be reestablished. Their cores or their guts can be reestablished just in time as needed. And that helps handle and rein in the memory consumption. But that has been quite a challenge on and off over the years, is trying to keep memory consumption down. And but it's still on 32-bit, it's a problem. And there's no it's not very graceful when it runs out of memory. It'll just crash, unfortunately.
That's probably
but even not some 64-bit, you know, operating systems, people will only have 4 gigs of RAM. And it can be constraining there, too. Because, you know, you got your operating system using half a gig, your web browser using a gig, and then, you know, the application's down to only having 2 gigs or so to work with.
Cool. Actually, a question from the chat room here first. Reverb Mike asks, I don't know the answer to this, but I'll let you answer it. Do you have YouTube tutorials like the other NLEs?
Yeah. There's on the website, there's on the navigation bar, a tutorials, navigation button item. And there's a page that has a bunch of tutorials. And then there's a channel. Recently, my getting started video, which was quite old and out of date now, got pulled down from YouTube by YouTube for BBC, filed a claim against some. I was using some kind of a little video in the background while showing some stuff in the UI. So that, it got by this point, over 500,000 views somewhere. I don't know. I'd have to go back in and check the count, but maybe it's up to 700,000 views before it got pulled down. But it's time to make a new one. And one thing that I've been plagued with while making tutorial videos is having good voiceover audio quality. And so I've been thinking about getting a new mic. And then this interview came up and there was some instructions about having a good mic. So I just went ahead and took the plunge and bought a new mic so I can make a new video now, getting started video. I just plugged in a someone else's video temporarily. But there's also a paid tutorial course that's quite good and I recommend as well. And that there's an affiliate link for that. So I get a 25% kickback if people purchase that video course. It awesome. Helps a little.
Awesome. Well, I know Aaron's chomping at the bit to try to ask some questions. Yeah. I shouldn't hog the whole show, but I got one more question, then we'll hand it over to Aaron. So given that there's been, I didn't realize this much interest in Shotcut. I mean, if there's that many people that viewed the Getting Started video, obviously that's such a huge interest. What's the most unusual application that you're aware of that Shotcut's been used for?
Recently, I had a guy in Italy contact me about he wanted to try to do some customization of Shotcut for marking up soccer videos. So he has he supports some kind of I think semi-professional soccer teams in Italy where they're shooting video all the time, and they have a database basically of video clips. And they need to be able to have, from a database query, spit out a bunch of, a playlist of sorts that gets loaded into Shotcut. But he wants the ability to be able to pull up a clip and then annotate them with text and drawings like arrows and circles and stuff like that. But we don't have that capability yet.
Well, as I said, Aaron wants to actually ask you some questions. But before we do that, I have a very important message because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's talk about buying a home for a minute. Because of rising interest rates, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a home these days. It's causing a lot of anxiety with folks. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if the rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Again, that's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Aaron, your turn.
Yay, I get to talk. So I did actually remember how I think we met, Dan, and I think that's because you wrote a program for Linux to pull in back when we were using the digital cassettes in in our recording equipment before storage got capable. I think you wrote a little program to pull those, to import those into a digital file in Linux. Isn't that right? Or am I not remembering that right?
Start the program. I took over maintenance on it, but I was involved pretty early on with Linux FireWire and then maintaining the various protocol libraries and helping develop a kernel module called DB1394 and Video1394. These are all different mechanisms to control tape decks and capture video, and whether it's in DV or HDV format. So the program was called DVGrab, that command line program that you're referring to. And then then I worked on this application called Kino. So this other guy named Arnie, he created DVGrab, and then he created like a GUI front end to the DVGrab that was mainly keyboard driven, called Kino. And then I just started working with him after I didn't get anywhere working with Broadcast 2000. at that time, I didn't quite understand the contribution process, and I just asked if I could help, and I didn't get any response.
That's very common. I think that's a great lesson for people that want to get started on this kind of stuff, is that you do have to speak up and just say, hey, can I get started? And sometimes you get a response and sometimes you don't. So just keep trying for those of you who are in school.
Sometimes you have to have actually like a patch in hand to start getting some response, right? But this is the program, Broadcast 2000, that became Cinelair that you were referring to.
Right.
And so I took an interest in getting back into multimedia and especially in conjunction with Linux around the year 2000. And so I started out with FireWire and then took an interest in Broadcast 2000, didn't go anywhere with that. So I started working with DVGrab and then Kino, and then really grew Kino into quite a useful app that a lot of people liked.
Yeah.
But it was inherently DV-based. It didn't have any kind of foundation on which to be able to support different formats and being able to revise effects and stuff like that, or multiple tracks. Or
I always just pulled it in, you know, using DVGrab, and then I would run it through FFmpeg to get it in whatever format that I needed to shove it most effectively into Cinelera, and then edit it in Cinelera, and then blah, 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 export it out. It was a brilliant, big, long process. But one thing I noticed, like, I just started actually, I want to talk about some features if we have time for, you know, because we haven't talked about the actual features yet really that much. But I've got it open. I've used it a couple times as you've developed it through the years. And one thing I like about that is that process that we just talked about, that difficult process. I mean, you've really shortcutted that whole process, because I just opened up a file and it was ready to go, and I could just drag it down to the timeline. I mean, there was no delay, no like loading or importing of resources. I just threw it up there, put it in the timeline, and started dragging it over the scrubbing it over the timeline. And what I loved about it was it was playing the audio as well by default as I was. So this is a really nice, I mean, just out of the box, I just got to say, it's a really nice product. If you're used to video editing, you just come in and you're like, oh yeah, this works exactly the way I would expect it to work.
Well, you know, I was trying to make something that would be simple, that you could, start out simple and then grow and use more and more features. As far as that process of, you know, getting video in to the system, so to speak, well, a lot of that is largely due in part to FFmpeg and its support for various formats and codecs, and the Melt integration with FFmpeg to facilitate that as well. But also just because of technology changing and being more file-based, you know, all the cameras pretty much just spit out files now, and then there's some kind of a file transfer process, whether it's from USB or a cloud uploader, so to speak, and then you can download the files and then just work with them as files. So it's, you know, it's just kind of the way the industry is gone. It's making things easier and making things, you know, that, you know, the average user can do things that are so much more complex now than what they used to be able to. So the bar has been continually being raised, you know, as far as what their expectation is from the tool, and being able to deal with it. So that's been a little bit of a challenge, is trying to deal with people's expectations, users' expectations a little bit, you know. This product was not like developed behind a closed door for years and then launched, you know, from pretty much 8 months after I started working on it. I've been making monthly releases. So there was, I started working on the GUI, you know, in 2011, made the first download available June 2012. And then pretty much ever since then, there's been a new version every month.
Cool.
But so people, but they're expecting, you know, some of the earlier users, hey, you know, why doesn't it have this and that?
That must be a big, I'm sharing my screen now.
At the beginning, it didn't even
have
a timeline.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sharing my screen now so people can see what it looks like, because, you know, this is a video source here. I'm scrubbing across the timeline. One of my old videos that I've already edited. It's pretty cool. But, you know, maybe tell us a little bit about some of the features that are here, because, you know, I noticed that there was, for example, there was an EDL or an edit decision list. I mean, there's some pretty advanced
Let's talk a little bit more about that approach of going from simple to something more advanced. When, for the longest time, up until like just a couple of versions ago, the first launch experience would be that it just looked like a player. And that was one of the goals, was originally just to, it could be used as a player. I know there's a lot of people who want to be able to have a media player where it simply is able to step frame by frame, but forwards and backwards. And that's actually not very common, especially one that supports a lot of formats. So that was a goal. And then it also has support for dedicated SDI and HDMI output peripherals. So it could be used as a media player, but it could also just make as a, like, just be used as a clip-based system. You know, you don't have to use a whole timeline. You can, with just a clip project, you can trim your clip and you can filter it and you can encode it, export it. You know what I mean?
And are there any limits on that?
So it can be used as a file converter.
Because I know other, I was just going to say, are there any limits on that? Because I know I've been using Lightworks, and maybe I'll start using this now, but, you know, just because they do such a good job, but in terms of exporting, you know, they have limits on what you can export. I'm showing the all the different things you can export with now. Are there any limits on what size or anything like that, or can
there's
you go
no limits,
all the way
really,
up to 4K?
No.
Awesome.
Well,
awesome.
There's a limit of like 8K resolution.
Okay.
So you can only go up to 8192 by 8192.
Right. But that's the limit of the software. That's not a limit.
There is a limit of it's 8-bit. You know, there's a lot of options now. You know, if you're looking at like transcoders or some of the higher end video editors, you can output as 10-bit, or, you know, if you're working with, say, HDR, you need to be able to encode as 10-bit. So, unfortunately, that kind of requires that you compile some of the codecs like X264 and X265 as 10-bit, and then you lose the 8-bit option. And then people, you know, they might output an 8-bit, I mean, sorry, a 10-bit that is not usable by certain other tools or devices. So you kind of get stuck locked into that. So I have to think about, you know, a way to move forward with HDR and being able to output as 10-bit.
Right.
But let's get back to the idea of ramping up your, as a user, you know, your skill level. So I said, you know, you could just do something clip-based. Well, then the next natural progression is you add that clip that you've or a shot that you've trimmed and filtered into a playlist. And you can do another section of that same clip and add it to the playlist, or you can add in, open up another clip and trim it and filter it and add it to the playlist. So you can just, at this point, you're not even working with multiple tracks. You can just, a lot of people are familiar with the concept of a playlist, you know, from media players and so forth. And so the idea was, oh, you can just advance from a clip-based, you know, simple single clip-based thing to a playlist. And then from there, you can advance to, let's say you need to lay down an audio, you know, music bed to your, so then you could start getting again to multiple tracks, and then you can move to the timeline. So that's was one of the ideas of it. But people get got confused about that message along the way. And they now they think that you always have to add clips into the playlist in order to even do anything with them. And they think, oh, you always have to use the timeline, even if you're just like using it to convert, you know, to transcode.
Right. No, I mean, it's really slick. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what features have you added recently that were, you know, specifically requested from the community?
That's interesting. Because I generally don't take feature requests. I will listen to them and kind of factor them in with, you know, what I'm feeling inspired to work on at a particular time and my idea about what I want to do. But my idea is mostly centered around trying to leverage and expose as much of the engine as possible at this time. And not a whole lot on UI or, you know, based additions, but I would say that the big thing there is the addition of keyframes and being able to interpolate parameters of effects over time. That was added to the engine quite a while ago, but once you add it to the engine, then you need to, like, for all of the different plugins, you need to touch them to leverage the time-based functions. So that was never completely done. It's still not completely done, but getting it exposed into the UI has helped push it further. Definitely.
Yeah, I so noticed keyframes right away when I opened it up.
And that's also been the source of some challenge and frustration lately, is trying to introduce a major feature like that that is so intertwined with everything else, mm-hmm. and not introduce a lot of bugs and instability in the process. But there has been a lot of instability introduced recently as a result of that. And yeah. So there's been a renewed focus recently on stabilization. So that's just kind of the way I roll with this a little bit, is to what I call, like with bodybuilding, is to bulk up and then cut, you know, to start to trim and stabilize again. And then there will be another feature addition later on. But I have to figure out, you know, some way to less expose all the entire user base to these major changes that are potentially destabilizing. Yeah. So I'll probably have to move to some kind of like a, you know, testing beta stable channel system of distribution.
Yep. one more question, and then I probably got to turn it back over to Randall, because there's so many things we've been talking about here. Actually, two more questions. Okay. One is, what about uploading? A lot of people want the easy button, right? So they want to, you know, just upload it right to YouTube or upload it right to Twitch or whatever platform they're using these days. Do you support that, or do you have plans to support that?
No, it does not support that right now. I think about it sometimes, but there's no definite plans at the moment. You know, there's, I don't know. It's so easy just to take your file and drag it into the web browser. I don't know what the big deal is. It's just like, right now there's not a feature to browse files in the tool. It's like every operating system provides already a good file browser. You know, why do I have to reinvent that wheel? Just drag them into the window.
Yeah.
Like, cool. I said, I'm focused mainly on trying to expose as much of the engine capabilities as possible. It's like there's a whole bunch of filters and transitions that are still not integrated. For instance, the ability to define a mask by, you know, being able to draw an outline of an area, for instance. You know, that's right. a great advanced feature to be able to add, but it hasn't been added. You know,
yeah. So
there's a lot of people who want to do
quite a bit on Cinelera, actually. Yeah, that's exactly what I was gonna ask you about. And then I know we're running out of time, so I'll turn it over to Randall after this. Okay. But what effects do you support? You must support like fading and cross cutting and things like that. Any other effect, you know, text effects, things like that people would normally expect an editor to have?
Well, it has the capability of text for sure. There's a lot of effects. If you go to the features page, they're all listed. But if you go to the MLT documentation and there's a section on plugins, you'll see a whole bunch more effects that aren't even in there. Now, for text, the way that's exposed is a little odd at the moment. Most people are looking for some kind of like text track or text object, so to speak. But the way it's exposed in the tool right now is as a filter. So you have to select a clip. And then you add text on top of it. And I think that works for most people because they want to use an image or an existing, you know, the beginning part of their video to put the text on. So that also kind of works, except then it makes it a little bit challenging to be able to fade the text in, you know, its opacity and then fade it back out over time. So for that, you need to basically create a transparent color clip and then put the text on that as a text filter. That does have recently just got added keyframing for the size and position parameters on the text. So you can animate the motion of it, slide it in, you know, make it slightly, you know, zoom in and out, if you will. So those are cool, except, of course, once you do that, then people ask for more. Now they want motion blur while it's while it's moving around. It's like,
Hey,
we don't have that yet.
can't please everybody. I totally understand that. Hey, we're really almost out of time. And for those of you playing along at home and trying to figure out why we're stopping the show early, it's because we got started taping late and we have hard outs here at the studio. So anyway, I do have a couple of interesting questions, though, for you, I bet. Well, I'm hoping they're interesting. Community, is this just you doing this? Do you have a bunch of people working with you, and is this being publicly done like on GitHub or something?
It's primarily me on both the engine and Shotcut. I do have some people who help out occasionally on both of those fronts. You know, so there's other users of Melt, including Caden Live and Flowblade. The Caden Live team occasionally, you know, they help out there. But I have this other guy named Brian. Hey, Brian. He helps out on both of those. I would say on a consistent periodic basis, let's put it that way. And then there was another gentleman who helped out a little bit on Shotcut a few years back named Harold. But he's kind of dropped out. He worked on some of the timeline and playlist. Other than that, it's largely just me. It would be nice to get more contribution. That's been one of the challenges, is trying to, get people interested in trying to contribute. And I created to try to encourage that, I created some SDKs, for Shotcut. They're buried in the website a little bit. If you go to the sitemap, then you'll find these pages that explain how to get started developing, how to set up your system with Qt Creator and download the SDK and our build of Qt to be able to get started developing on Shotcut and Melt. So those are available for Linux and Windows at this time. But as far as I know, there's just maybe some company in China that's using it to make illegitimate forks of Shotcut. So.
Hey, one other question then. What's the funding model for this? Is this a labor of love for you, or do you have commercial interests in keeping this moving forward?
Well, Melt was originally developed under contract, you know. And then I went back after working on that. I went back to working on Kino and kind of like took that as far as I could take it without a greater foundation. And meanwhile, Caden Live started using Melt. And then I was like, okay, I'll start helping them and working on Melt. So I went back to Melt and got more contract work off and on. So that was nice to help keep that sustaining. It was a nice side job. And then with Shotcut, it was basically just like a labor of love with some intentions that I mentioned earlier about a Melt-based rendering service. But then I decided initially I was hosting all the downloads and that was starting to cost me some money. So I was like, well, I'll try to find some ways to monetize a little to offset those costs and try to make it pay for itself, you know, instead of coming all out of my pocket. Eventually that led to advertising on the website. And so now that's the funding model and it's going great now. So it took a few years for the popularity to build up, but now it makes enough money advertising just on the website that I can work on it full time.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. It's definitely a success. Yeah. I appreciate that. Appreciate that. So one of the things I just want to make one comment, then I have two more questions, then we got to get out of the show. So one of the comments is that this project suffers from a similar problem to a number of projects, that the people that want features in this are probably not skillful enough, skilled in the right ways to actually add the features. Because this is not sort of a dog fooding kind of thing. There's an end user market for this thing, and then there's the programmers on the other side, and rarely do they overlap. You're one of the overlap, obviously, but that's definitely a problem with a project like this. So we'll put the call out on this show. You know, if anybody wants to help you, they know where to find you. I have two last questions. One is, what's your favorite scripting language?
I would say JavaScript now.
Okay, good. And what's your favorite text editor?
Well, I'm primarily working in Qt Creator. It's an IDE. It's not just a text editor.
Sure.
Does that answer your question? As far as a text-based one, it's Vim.
I'm an Emacs user, but Aaron's a Vim user. Okay, hey, it's been really great having you on. I'm sorry we ran out of time end here, because I could have gone on for another hour. There's so much depth to this. Maybe I'll have you back on in a year or two, and you can tell us where Shotcut's gone in the next year. So that'll be cool. So thank you for coming on the show and explaining Shotcut to us, and I hope you'll have a bunch more users and hopefully a few more programmers.
Yep, thank you. Appreciate it.
Great. That was Dan Dennity talking to us about Shotcut. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, I mean, you can guess what I thought, right? I think, I can definitely see myself using this on a day-to-day basis. There's still, in terms of the effects and things, I think there's still some things that I would want, but I'm going to do my next video in this for sure and see, you know, you have to play with it, right? Video editors, they might look the same, but they all have their quirks and they're very different. And until you use them, you know, you just don't know. So I'm going to actually use this to do my next video that I do personally at home and see how it goes. But, you know, it's such a great start. And he's done something that I think is important for software developers to emulate, which is he started with a really good foundation, right? He started with a framework. This Melt system and thing that he's worked on for so long, and then that works so well. So now he can take that and turn it into a product like this and build on top of it. And I know it's really tempting just to jump the gun, especially when you're developing software, and go right for the, you know, the end goal here. But he took his time. He developed a framework that worked really well. And then that's, I think he would say, you know, we can't talk to him now, but, you know, I think that he would say that that probably was a great way, because now he can build on top of that framework to build Shotcut and it sounds like other things as well. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and I only got to play with this for maybe about 10 or 15 minutes. But one of the things I noticed is I brought a video in that I had downloaded off the net, and it said this has a variable timeline, and you'd have to rebuild the timeline in order to be able to step through it consistently and easily. So I didn't get a chance to ask him about that, but you know, that was my first shocking thing about it. But maybe that's true with all editors with this particular video. So variable rate timeline. Or
interesting.
Something. Really strange. Yeah, I hadn't seen a video like that before, so I had no idea what that is. Anyway, I got to finish. So let's talk about the upcoming guests. We've got Lindstor coming up. That's high availability DRDB. We've got Hacks, which is an open source tool aiming to make online course creation accessible to all instructors. I may be personally interested in that. That may be one of the projects I have to download and play with. Monero, cryptocurrency, but private, untraceable, and fungible. Aon, canceled, but they're back. So they're back in there, and that's a multi-tier system designed to address unsolved questions of scalability, interoperability, and blockchain networks. Oh, look what that does. That puts two blockchain shows right next to each other. Just added, and I think, Aaron, you may be interested in this, Sanoid. It's a policy-driven snapshot management and replication tool currently using ZFS for underlying next-gen storage, with explicit plans to support ButterFS when ButterFS becomes more reliable, primarily intended for Linux, but BSD use is supported and reasonably frequently tested. Is this only something, Aaron, you want to be on for?
Yes, very interesting. That goes right back into my background at Sun, so that's great.
I know. We'll check in the schedule and try to add yourself to the list there then. And then just also added the schedule, I saw Vicky Brasseur as the keynote speaker at the Pro Conference a few weeks ago. She talked about the importance of the ecosystem and how we're polluting it sometimes by some of our toxic behaviors. It was a very moving keynote. She's going to come on and talk about her new book, Contributing to Open Source. And we'll talk a lot about just open source ecosystems. So if you guys wanted a generic show where we just talk about what open source is all about, I think this is going to be your show. So that'll be great as well. So that's who we got online. I'm still soliciting more guests. If we go to twit.tv/floss, that's the homepage for this show. If you have other suggestions, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me, especially if it's not cryptocurrency, okay? We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We have a live chat room there. We take questions from that. We took a couple questions, I think, today. Sorry we didn't get to everybody's questions. It was just this show had to be a little short because of the timing. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I was interviewed for Software Engineering Daily on the July 11th show. Just have to Google Randall Schwartz Software Engineering Daily. I couldn't find a short link for that. I was interviewed about Flutter, so it's an hour-long talk on Flutter, my new passion. I'll be at DragonCon in 2 weeks. For Labor Day weekend. If you're there at DragonCon, please come up and say hi. I have 5 sessions on the EFF track, including another presentation of my Flutter talk, which will be great. I'm going to be at All Things Open in Raleigh in October. It was just confirmed also that I'm giving that talk again in Raleigh. I'm also going as press, obviously. I'm going to try to get more guests for our show. 5,000 attendees at that thing. It's a huge show. Amazing stuff. And I'll be at Siegel in November. That's a Seattle GNU Linux show. And I haven't solicited it yet, but I'm probably going to give my Flutter talk there as well. Anything you want to plug, Aaron, quickly?
Really quickly, go buy Linux for Makers if you haven't already, or if you know someone that's getting started with a Raspberry Pi and doesn't understand Linux, is a little afraid to use Linux. It's a great book, a great primer for Linux on Raspberry Pi. Benicia Makerspace, we're looking for funding. We've hit one of those dips in our funding cycles, as sometimes happens with these organizations. So if you're interested in contributing, or you might know work for a company or something like that that wants to sponsor us, please reach out and let me know on Facebook, Twitter, whatever works for you. And thanks to AppDynamics for letting me contribute to the show today, giving me the time to do that. It's great.
Awesome, awesome. And Aaron, your insights were very welcome. And I'm sorry we didn't get a lot longer to talk to him, because that would have been really fun. So anyway,
yeah,
thanks again for co-hosting the show. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.